we may have outdone ourselves tonight with perhaps the most exciting guest we've ever had. Certainly, he needs no introduction, but I'm going to give one anyway. Tonight, we welcome to the show Mr. Andrew M. Allen. Andrew's a test pilot, Top Gun, United States Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, and a space shuttle astronaut. Aerodyne CEO Andrew Allen has had a distinguished and heralded career that spans more than 45 years in the aerospace industry. Andy has logged more than 900 hours in space as a pilot and mission commander for three space shuttle missions. His career literally spanned the globe from a Marine Top Gun fighter pilot to three stints as a space shuttle pilot and mission commander to his current role as chief executive officer for Aerodyne Industries, LLC in Cape Canaveral, Florida. In 2022, Andy was honored by Ernst & Young with Florida's Entrepreneur of the Year Award for growth and success of Aerodyne Industries. In 2017, he was recognized by the National Space Club Florida Committee and the Space Heroes and Legends Award, Florida's most prestigious space industry honor. He has received numerous other honors during his illustrious career, including the Defense Superior Service Medal, Legion of Merit, Distinguished Flying Cross, NASA Outstanding Leadership Medal, and NASA Exceptional Service Medal. We are thrilled and honored that he took the time to come on our show today. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Andy Allen. Mr. Allen, tell us, you started off as a test pilot. Was it F-4s? How did you start off with? How did that play out?
So, wanted to be a pilot since I was young. Went to school on an ROTC scholarship, Navy ROTC, but switched to Marine Corps. Came out in the Marine Corps after college and flew. Went to flight school, flew F-4 Phantoms. That was my first, what they call, fleet airplane. And then from F-4 Phantoms, we had a new airplane coming out called the F-18. And I got selected to fly in the F-18s when the first squadrons were getting put together. And then from F-18s, while I was in F-18s, that's when I did the postgraduate schools, what people know as Top Gun, not quite like the movie. Kelly McGillis wasn't there, but it was still a good school to go to. And
that's incredible.
And I also had another graduate level school called Weapons and Tactics course that they teach in the Marine Corps.
When you
out of F-18s, I went into test pilot school so I could be a test pilot and got accepted into that. And then from there, I went into NASA.
That's incredible. When you watch films like Top Gun, is it funny to you? Are you like, this is just not how it is? Or is it just kind of entertainment? How do you take it?
I take it as entertainment because if I get too technical, then it kind of ruins the movie for me.
Yeah.
Even though I would say in the second movie, the flying sequences were actually pretty good. So they met my standard because they were actually flying sequences. In the first movie, I was actually on the periphery of the movie being made. I had met Tom Cruise prior to them making the movie, just happened to be at the happy hour that he was at at the officers' club.
Wow.
After I had graduated from Top Gun. And I would go down there a lot and do work with the Top Gun instructors in between classes and things. So I got to know all the Top Gun instructors pretty well. And there was a point in time that I almost became a Top Gun instructor. So there was a relationship that was there when the movie was being made. But the flying sequences in the movie didn't go so great, mostly because the actors just didn't do well in the airplanes, including Mr. Cruise.
When they were in the back of the Rio seat, they're just, they weren't used to that.
Yeah, and a lot of them got sick pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And sometimes when Hollywood comes out to do something, a small example, which is kind of funny, was we had a guy in our squadron that the night we met Tom Cruise, there's two beautiful women that were there, right next to him on each side of him. And we had no idea who he was. And he went up to talk to the girls, ladies. And and they said this was Tom Cruise. And he's asked if that was some admiral's son or something, because he had no idea who he was. And then as they talked about making a movie about fighter pilots and Top Gun, and then the then these two guys that were in my squad, and they got into the whole, well, so you're going to pay them a whole lot of money to pretend what I do, to pretend what I do.
Right.
Why don't you just go out with me?
Yeah. Right. Well, why skip over the real thing? You can have.
Yeah.
You can have
so Andrew the girls had no interest in that. So he got shot down pretty well. But in the second movie, you know, they did a pretty good job of the flying sequences. That, you know, you can pick it apart technically in some areas here and there. And of course, we don't quite have all the Hollywood love stories that they have in the movies at Top Gun, even though there's plenty to go around with all kinds of individual things going on with people and people's lives, but not quite like the movie. But the bars are good and the fun is good. And sometimes we played beach volleyball in between the things that we were doing. And so they did a pretty decent job. I think what really did the job justice, and what I really picked out of the movies and liked the movies, which happens to me a lot when I watch war movies or military movies. You know, I can get real technical real fast and don't necessarily want to do that. And the bigger picture is, you know, what's the audience getting out of it? So I think out of the first Top Gun movie, there was a pretty significant increase in people wanting to go join the Navy and be a fighter pilot. And so that's not a bad thing, because most people don't get there. It's actually a very small percentage that get to that point. So it's good that the more people that want to do it. So actually, as a recruiting tool, it was pretty good. And it was kind of funny because I recognized a lot of the areas in the second movie because I flew in some of those same areas. So they used some of the, what we call restricted areas where we did our training, and they were in the movie. So I could see a mountain range, or I could see a valley, and I could recognize it as a valley and a mountain range that I used to fly, that I had been there before.
That's incredible.
So that was kind of fun to do that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the second movie was pretty good on the flying. And you could tell watching the movie that the actors actually got to a point that they were actually pulling G's. You could just look at their faces and some of the sequences, you could tell that they're pulling G's. And they might have only been pulling 3 G's instead of 9 G's, but even still, they were pulling G's.
They were pulling
G's. So you could see the sequences and the way they had to set up the cameras. And I talked to some of my friends that were doing all that. The Navy did a pretty good job. The Navy did a pretty great job of supporting this movie. And the reason they did that was because at the end of the day, it was going to do justice for the Navy. And there are Marines. The Marine and Navy pilots all do the same training, all kind of do the same thing. But it's okay for the Navy to get the highlight. I got a son that just joined the Navy here a few months ago.
Congratulations.
And he's down in Pensacola, Florida, waiting to start flight school. So he thinks he wants to be a fighter pilot. So we'll see how that goes.
Oh, congratulations. Thank you and him for your service. Is he, so if you join Navy and you become a naval aviator, is it, would he be flying, I know they're not flying the Phantoms anymore. Would it be the Super Hornets that the main?
So the airplanes that he hopes to be able to fly would be either the F-18 or the new F-35s, the Joint Strike Fighters.
Yeah, those are incredible.
And there's a lot of other airplanes that you can fly that he may end up flying. Everything from helicopters to cargo aircraft to early radar warning and those kinds of airplanes. But again, you know, he wants to be the fighter guy.
Of course. So when you flew, your trajectory was when you were flying the F-4s and you graduated Top Gun, you obviously had a lot of options at that point, so on and so forth with the F-18s. You joined NASA 1987? What was the culture like? Because this was 2 years after Challenger. What was the culture? Bob, how would you phrase this?
Yeah, just walking into that, and I know, you know, after you had the Rogers Commission report come out, and, you know, there were a lot of changes going on at NASA, and I just thought it you know, had to be pretty interesting coming in at that time in that first astronaut class after just, you know, a year and a half after the Challenger situation.
So Challenger, when Challenger happens, it was a day that, you know, for those that were around during those time frames, it was one of those days that, and the same thing when Columbia was lost, you know, many years later. But it's one of those days, I call them the days that the Earth stood still, which is, by the way, one of my favorite movies, The Day the Earth Stood Still, made back in the 50s or 60s.
50s, right.
And everybody kind of remembers what they were doing, where they were, the feelings that they had. And the Challenger was kind of one of those days. And I was actually flying in an F-18 when I heard about it. I was just coming back from some bombing ranges, practicing live bombing in some ranges out near Yuma, Arizona.
Wow.
And air traffic control told us about it. So I came back and just started watching the repeats of the explosion over and over and over again on TV. And then shortly after that, I went into test pilot school. And then while I was in test pilot school, NASA came out and said they were going to look for a new class of astronauts. And while I was in test pilot school, I actually decided to apply, even though very few get selected their first time around. And from the big picture, I was probably a pretty inexperienced applicant, you know, not a lot of test pilot experience behind me. So it was quite a long shot, but I figured I would apply just because most folks take a number of tries before they get selected. And so when I got selected, you know, you go through all the negatives of all that and you think about it. And I was doing an interview with, I can't remember whether it was a hometown newspaper or wherever it was, but being in the first class of astronauts since Challenger, as we were trying to get back into the swing of going flying again, when a tragedy like that happens, someone had asked me why, you know, why would I do that? I mean, why would you go to NASA and be in the first class of astronauts after this big tragedy that we had, not knowing that we were actually going to go fly again in space? And my answer was kind of along the lines of, well, from a safety perspective, sometimes after an accident, you're more safe than before the accident because you learn a lot. And eventually, this nation, this government, this NASA is going to overcome this setback because that's what we do. That's what this country does. So I knew it was going to happen, and I thought me being a part of it would be a great opportunity to have. And I also told them, you know, from a danger perspective, you know, my life has always been about risk. It still is. Just it changes in different categories. Sometimes it's about life and death. Sometimes it's about other people controlling life and death scenarios and managing those people. And then sometimes it's about business because business brings risk in it on its own. But they all add stress into your life. They don't all kill you, but they all add stress into your life. Sure. Having kids adds stress into your life. But I ended up telling, as far as risk goes, you know, my life has been risk, and I didn't think that being in NASA and riding on a rocket was going to be any worse than being a test pilot or landing on an aircraft carrier or going to war in a fighter. Or driving on the Schuylkill Expressway. I mean, to me, as you measure all those risks, at least I know, and I say that a lot because at least when I know when I'm in the air, I'm there with a lot of professionals that take their job pretty seriously and have to be well-trained. And so that to me is a safe environment. You know, things happen and bad things can happen. And I compare that to I-95 and the Schuylkill Expressway because, you know, I had two accidents on the Schuylkill when I was going through college.
Oh, man.
You know, and it's just that sure kill expressway because there's always something going on. And the last thing I think people aren't as qualified to be driving as they should be, and they're not professionals and they're not going through special school. They're being hand selected to do things or going through selection boards, they just get behind a car and just drive and
have at it. Yeah.
Have at it. And so they're the bigger risk than being up there with a bunch of pros.
I always felt that way with that's a really good analysis, and I always felt that way with moving vans. You know, you need a C class to drive a truck, but if you want to rent a U-Haul, it's 50 feet, have at it, no problem.
Right.
But it's just bizarre that we allow that. So when you talk about, obviously, NASA, everyone takes their job seriously, and it's just down just such a calculated and uncalculated risks with different things. What was the time frame when NASA, you approached them, they approached you, and the first STS mission that you were on? Was it several years of training? Like how did that all unfold and play out?
Well, so I put in the application, and actually was told by some folks not to even apply, because there's no way I could ever get selected, you know, where I was at, because I was still a student at test pilot school. You know, I was pretty experienced, but the pilot astronauts they pick are all test pilots. They've all got a test pilot pedigree or credential. And since I was just starting in the school, some of the folks that would have to do my recommendations and my endorsements, they said, don't even bother applying, because I'm not going to do your recommendation endorsements, because you have no chance of ever getting accepted or being there. So it's a waste of our time, your time and our time.
I think you showed
up. Senior officers.
Sure.
Well, and I met a guy who happened to be the senior Marine in charge of all the Marines during happy hour on a Friday night. And he came up to me and asked me if I was going to apply. And I said, no, sir, I'm not applying. The commanding officer of test pilot school came in there and said, you guys in the junior class, test pilot school is a year long. So half of it's you're in the junior class and half you're in the senior class. I said, they came out and they said, well, you know, don't bother, because we have some very highly qualified people that will be applying and you don't have a shot. And you just waste the paperwork. And he said, don't worry about them. He said other more words, but I don't know whether you're PG rated or R rated. So I'll just keep it to the,
company. It's okay. Anything's fine.
He had other descriptions, but at the bottom line, he says, just apply, because you never know.
Yeah.
And at the end of all of that, I'll endorse you. So I'll write your letter of recommendation. I'll endorse you. See what happens. So I did. And then the process is a long process. So each branch of the service that they have people, the selection process is the hardest part to do. The hardest thing about being an astronaut is getting selected to be an astronaut. After that, it's actually pretty easy. It's just not that hard. There's going to be lots of people teaching you. There's going to be lots of people making sure that you're successful. There's going to be a lot of pros that you're going to be working with. So that's the easy part. You're still going to work and you still have a whole lot of challenges. But the process of getting selected is really the part. And I divide it into three categories. There's the resume. You got to have a resume that's very competitive. And that's flying, or if you're a mission specialist, being a super engineer, or super physicist, or medical doctor, or whatever. Then there's the part about your endorsements. Endorsements is what happens when you're not in the room, what people say when you're not in the room. It's kind of like what people say at your funeral. You know, and you don't know what they're going to say at your funeral. So you ought to live life like you want them to say good things at your funeral. Well,
sure.
Same kind of thing. When people get behind closed doors, you know, what are they going to say about you? And those are your endorsements. And then the third piece is, for lack of anything better, I call the presence piece. It's just your presence. You know, how do you present yourself? And for NASA, is this the person that I'm comfortable with being in front of a camera? And this person won't embarrass NASA and won't do really stupid things that get bad press, which does happen sometimes, but you know, they're looking at that. And can this person handle the stress and get through all of that and still have a good presence with the media? Because we're going to get a lot of the media attention. When you get selected by the service and you go up against all the other applicants and the other services, so I was in the Marine Corps. So the Marine Corps selected, I think they had a couple thousand applicants. They selected 21. And then they send those names to NASA and say, okay, here's the 21 Marines we think you should look.
Oh, wow.
The best of the best right there.
Yeah, and then there's probably another 12 or 15,000 applicants if you include all the other services and you include all the mission specialists that applied direct in that, so if you're not in the military at the time. And they screen all of that out. And then they get down to an interview process, and they interview generally 120 people, 20 people at a time over 6 weeks. It's a week-long interview. So you're there for a week. Most of it's physical stuff. And of course, you get to spend a few hours. You get 2 4-hour interviews with psychiatrists and psychologists. And you take a bunch of the mental tests, the psychiatric tests that they give you, like, would you rather hit your thumb with a hammer or throw up on a crowded bus? Pick one.
Really?
And then you figure out which one you want to pick. And then they figure all that out. So that interview process is a week long, and they interview 120. So out of those Marines, out of the 21 Marines that the Marine Corps picked, NASA selected 6 of them to interview. So there were 6 Marine Corps interviewees, 120 total interviewees out of the however many thousands, 12,000, whatever it was that applied. And they selected 15 astronauts that year by year.
Wow.
One Marine. They had their one token Marine, and that was me.
That's incredible. I mean, so just to be in that.
The process is the hard part.
Sure, sure. And what a process, too. And just to be in that pool, to make it is incredible.
Before I flew, it was about 5 years. So with all the experience and all the training I had, it was another 5 years of training before I got my first flight.
What was that like? Your first flight was STS-46 on Atlantis. I guess, you know, you have 5 years, all this buildup, all the training, all the work you've put in, kind of almost like the pinnacle of your career, I would think, would be when you're rolling up in that Astro van and, you know, you're rolling up to the launch pad and you guys are getting ready to get on this thing and go to space. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it's very surreal and motivating. By that time, we're probably, not probably, I think we're the best trained people in the world. I mean, we've had thousands of people preparing us and hundreds of people doing day-to-day training of us. So we're ready to go. And you're very disciplined and very focused to go. But you get out there and you're looking at it from the Astrovan. And in my case, it was right around dawn. But you know, you get strapped in about 3.5 hours before liftoff. And so we're going in and it's just about dawn, and this vehicle has got the xenon lights on it, and it's a machine and it's venting and there's smoke coming out and there's a little bit of wind, so it's actually heaving a little bit. So you're taking a look at this thinking, you know, wow, this is what I've worked for. You know, this is kind of a dream come true, that adventure that I'm going to have, that I don't know how it's going to turn out, but I know I'm going to have an adventure if this thing launches. But I'm ready. And then if I'm not ready, it's too bad, because the families are all there. There's my kids and my aunts and my uncles and my siblings and parents and cousins I didn't know I have. They've all come out to the launch. To watch this launch, and they're all there and they're filling in the stands, and you've got a real mission to perform, and you don't want to mess it up. There's things that you do in your training. There's things that you know that no matter what happens, you can't do anything about it. Challenger, Columbia, you just can't do anything about it. It's just not a good day. And so you think through that a little bit, and you go through the process of saying, well, if I can't do anything about it, I might as well not worry about it. It's a nice way to set priorities in life. I always tell people, they really have a problem setting priorities, go get strapped into a rocket for a while and it'll help you set your priorities in life and what your priorities ought to be. So don't sweat the small stuff and the stuff you can't change. And there's a lot of things that can happen that are really easy, piece of cake. I mean, anybody with minimal training can handle the emergencies. But then there's a ton of emergencies that you've got to be right on. You've got to be with split second timing on your diagnostics and your reactions, and there's 1500 switches that you've got to make sure that you've got a handle on, knowing which one, because you flip the wrong switch, turn the wrong knob, it can ruin everybody's day, especially if you're a front seater commander and pilot. And so you think about it, you think about that, and you get to the point that, you know, I'm prepared. At the same time, you're dealing with real life. So you get out, we go up to the 195 foot level, we go up the elevator, and I've got about 10 minutes before I'm strapping in. Commander is going to get strapped in first. I'm flying with the pilot, so I'm going to strap in second. And, you know, a couple things. So one is there's a beat up old bathroom up there at that level, and maybe I should go to the bathroom before I go fly. You know, I mean,
sure, yeah.
I've been in my diaper now for a couple hours and had a big breakfast, and it was a breakfast, it was a dinner for me. But you're in this big pressure suit, so it takes a lot of dexterity and flexibility to be able to. So it's almost an act of accomplishment to be able to get out of your pressure suit enough to go to the bathroom before you go fly. So I wanted to see if I could do that, so I did. And then as I'm walking up to the I call it the gangplank, but it's the pathway that you're going to get into the vehicle. There's a box, and inside the box is all beat up, and inside the box is a phone. And I open up the box, and there's a phone. And I didn't know if the phone worked, so I picked the phone up, and I decided that, well, maybe my daughters are eating breakfast. Maybe I can call my daughters. So I try to call an outside line, and it won't let me have an outside line. So I call what they call the crew quarters, the astronaut office, where we stay in quarantine. And the executive there answers the phone. And I said, her name was Nancy. I said, "Hey, Nancy, this is Annie." She says, "What are you doing calling me? Don't you have something better to be doing?" And I was like, "Yeah, but
yeah.
Can you patch me into an outside line?" Why? And I said, "Well, you know, I want to say hi to my daughters."
Oh, wow.
"Yeah, well, let me try." So she patched me in the outside line and called the condo where the girls were at and got on the phone with them for a little while. And they're eating cereal and getting ready to go. And they could care less anyhow. Get that work on the scene.
Oh, that's so cool.
So you got to talk. And then I made that a tradition for every flight. I made it a tradition that I'd go out there, I'd go visit the bathroom, and then I would go make a phone call.
It's incredible. It's incredible, too, that you can say every flight. You know, people dream a lifetime in training just to have a shot at that opportunity. But to be able to travel in space and, you know, multiple times, just truly astonishing.
And you can't train for one thing at a time. Just to finish off on the question.
I'm sorry, please. Please.
You have to do it in pieces. So we fly a shuttle training airplane. That gets us to a point of helping do the landing. We fly the simulators all the time, and there's a simulator that gives you a little bit of motion, and we'll go vertical on it. It's not quite vertical, but 60 degrees up, and it'll shake and rattle and roll for you a little bit. And there's another one that's a fixed base simulator that just gets you into the procedures and where the layout of the deck is. Then you're going to have three or four other different kinds of trainers that all do a little piece of what you're going to do, but it doesn't all come together until you go fly. And when the main engines light off 6.5 seconds prior to liftoff, there's no doubt that there's something going on, but they can be shut down while the diagnostics happen. But then when the boosters light off right at T0, I mean, there's no doubt a significant event has just occurred in your life, because you're going to go fly. There's no shutting them down. You're off. You don't know how it's going to turn out and where it's going to end up, but you're off. And hopefully you'll do well and not embarrass yourself or NASA during your mission. Come back and tell stories.
And here you are. That point of no return where you're going to fly, you're going. What's kind of going through your mind during this spot? Are you thinking about your family? Are you doing a checklist mentally? Like, how does that?
So when you get strapped in, like I said, you get strapped in 3 to 3.5 hours prior to liftoff. We're not that busy. There's not a lot to do. So some folks catch a little nap. Some folks just kind of read through procedures and refresh themselves. Some folks talk. tell jokes. But most of us, for the most part, most of us are a little bit retrospective at the time that we're just kind of thinking through things. But you know, there is that thought, especially when you're a front seater and you're looking out the windows and you can see across to where the crowds are and the people are, that you want them all to have a good day. So that means you got to have a good day for them to have a good day. So you have a little bit of that that goes on in your head. But that's all pre-launch. And coming out of what we call the 9-minute hold, the last 9 minutes gets pretty busy. So you're going to have those kinds of reflective thoughts while you're in there. Some people will think about, you know, on my last flight, one of my friends had smuggled some letters up for my daughters. So I'm reading letters from my daughters, having a boo-hoo moment, you know, just prior to going to fly. So it's a variety of those kinds of things, pretty reflective, I guess. But you do, I didn't think too much about what's going to happen because I didn't know what was going to happen. The first time you ever see something go right in the simulator was the first time you ever fly in the simulator. After that, nothing ever went right. So when you go out to actually fly for the real thing, you want it to all go right. But the mindset you get yourself into is, okay, what does the simulation supervisor have in mind today of how many emergencies is he going to throw at me to keep us alive that I got to get us through? And that's kind of where your mind goes. So by the time you're coming out of the 9-minute hold, and you're getting pretty busy, you really don't have any time to think about anything else because you're in the zone. You're there, you're ready to go fly. And there's two little things that pilots get to think about that I was advised of or given the gouge on prior to my flight. You know, you're going to be really busy. You're going to be looking at displays. You're going to be watching everything like a hawk. Somewhere around 150,000 feet, just look outside. Just take 2 seconds to go look outside the window. Lift your eyes up from the displays and look out the window. And that's where you see the sky go from blue, 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 and then all of a sudden, it's really kind of a neat thing to see. And it's one of those things you can describe. I'm not gifted in the humanities, but it's a unique kind of a sight to see. And then the other thing for the pilots is right at main engine cutoff, as you get through what's called 3G throttling and you get into 0G, raise your seat up all the way, reach down, and there's an electric switch, and raise your seat all the way up to the top so you can kind of see over the nose. And then you can watch, one, the external tank get blown off the orbiter. And two is you'll start to get a great vision and visibility of the Earth. And by that time, you're generally over Africa. So,
wow.
Looking down.
That's only something you can really experience to articulate that. I mean, we'll never know unless you're there what that's truly like, but that's just incredible, truly.
If you don't mind me jumping in here, Matt, you talked about, you know, going through the procedures and, you know, looking at, you know, what the sim soup tortures you guys in training. And I've always wondered this about the space shuttle. You guys have basically three abort modes when you're going uphill into orbit, which is RTLS, TAL, and ATO. And we only saw one shuttle Challenger in 1985 actually do the abort to orbit. I always wondered the viability of the return to launch site, RTLS abort, and how often you guys actually practice that in the simulators, and just the, you know, just how successful would that be?
Well, great question. And we practice it every time we do an ascent simulation. So if you go into an ascent simulator, we call them ascent entry simulators. It'll go vertical or almost vertical on you. They're generally 4 hours long when you get into that simulator. And, wow. And then in that 4 hour time, you're going to do two or three ascents and one or two entries with all the emergencies that go along with all of that. And then debriefing in between each of the ascents or entries. But we'll always do at least one RTLS. We make it in the simulators, but we always question whether the reality of it would be that we would make it, because it has to be so precise. In theory, it works, but we're not sure it would happen for real. On my last flight, right at engine start on my last flight, the three engines start up, and both, and I had a rookie pilot, and I had a rookie, what we call the flight engineer, MS2, mission specialist number two, is the flight engineer. They're both rookies, and they're just eyeing the gauges and the instrumentation, the data, as these engines start up. So 6.5 seconds, you get the vibrations and the noise of the engines, and you get a little bit of a rock. We call it the twang. You rock forward in the orbiter because it's held down by
eight nuts.
Yeah. And so as you're watching the twang, you're watching it, one of the engines did not come up to full speed. So one of the engines did not go up to what's called 100%. And so as we're looking at it, my pilot calls it out. He jumped right on it and said, you know, left engine's low PC. And I'm looking at it, yeah, that really sucks, because that means another month of training, we'll probably have a pad abort. And I'm just depressed. And then as the twang's coming back, I'm thinking the engines are going to shut down, and then the boosters light. And so my pilot had just said, okay, I guess we'll do a pad abort, and then boom, the boosters light off. And on the intercom, you can hear them say, it doesn't matter anymore, we're going flying. So we go fly. And then the pilot right away says, okay, we need to look at RTLS procedures, because if that engine dies and it's not up to the full speed, chances are we're going to be doing an RTLS. So if you lose one engine early on in the first couple of minutes, you don't have enough velocity to get to any of the other orbit modes, abort modes. So you're going to end up doing the RTLS. It's only for the first couple minutes, minute and a half to 2 minutes, generally. And then you'll finally pick up your abort TAL mode, which means you can do a transatlantic and land over in Africa or Spain somewhere if you lose an engine. So we're watching it. We're going through the throttling. It felt right, but the instrumentation was all saying wrong. And then as we go through the throttling, so when we lift off, you know, you lift off, you do the roll, and it's really a communications check. You say, Houston, Columbia, roll program. And that's just the comm check, because you're switching from launch control to mission control in Houston, launch control at Kennedy, mission control in Houston. And then they answer you back, Roger, roll. So that's generally how the sequence goes. So in our case, I said, Houston, Columbia, roll program and low PC left, thinking I'd get a response. And all I got back was a Roger roll. I'm like, okay.
I think so it, I remember running up from school watching it. Yeah, I think you put like
something
like
30 seconds later, you're going through the throttle bucket and the engine's really acting up and really running at low power. And so going through the throttle bucket, we get the, you know, Columbia, go for throttle up. And Houston comes back and they say, you know, or the Houston comes up and they say, Columbia, Houston, go for throttle up. And then I come back, and generally you're supposed to say, Roger, throttle up. But I come back and I say, Roger, throttle up. How's that left PC look? Thinking, why is it taking you guys so long to tell me what's going on here?
Yeah, what's going on there?
And then I get the standard standby. And then a second or so later, they come back and they say, we're showing three good engines. So it turned out to be two unrelated instrumentation failures and a data card failure that all by themselves were one in a million. And then all of them happening at the same time were one in 100 million probabilities, but we got the probabilities. So our instrumentation, they have more data downstairs in mission control than we have on the vehicle. So we were talking about an RTLS for a little while, and I'm thinking, well, this will be interesting if we get through this thing. So we broke out our procedures and we were ready. If we had to do it, we would have done it.
That's wild. That's a lot too. Wow. Because we know you've done your homework on safety procedures. And when, I mean, does all that kick in memory, your training, when a potential situation arises?
Yeah, I think
checklist in your mind.
At our point in training and our point in our own skill sets that we pick up over the years, at that point, you're in kind of an auto mode. I mean, you're nothing but a machine. You know, you're kind of a robot on, here's what I got to do when I got to do it. And they've taught us so well. We spent so many thousands of hours in the simulators. You're just on top of it. But again, it's like you're in the zone and you don't, the emotion, you don't let any of the emotion come in until you're in orbit. And then the emotion kicks in. And then you're like, well, that was really cool. And then you think about what you just did, or you watch the videos that they send up of your launch and you're saying, wow, I'm here. This is really neat. I mean, the two things that you can't get enough, that you really can't know, no matter how much gouge you get or counseling or hints or anything, the two things that you'll never know until you get there. One of them is how you're going to react personally, how your body's going to react in zero gravity, because they're all going to be a little bit different. And our bodies are all going to react differently. The doctors spend gazillions of dollars studying all of us and doing medical experiments on all of us. Tell us, well, you're all a little bit different. We can't predict what your body's going to do in zero gravity. So you'll figure it out. And that's one. And then the second one is what the view is really going to be, because you've seen millions of pictures or thousands of pictures, but it just doesn't ever do it justice as being there.
It's not the same. Can't imagine.
So,
and I do have one more little nerdy question here. I always read from the astronauts that flew on Columbia that after STS-3, when they had to land at White Sands, that every time that Columbia went into orbit, there would be like this fine powder gypsum sand that would float out from the cracks and crevices of the vehicle that somehow got in there, you know, when they were unloading STS-3. I just wanted to know if you experienced that, you know, since you flew on, 62 and 75 on that shuttle.
I did not. By then, I think whatever was going to float up had floated up.
okay.
And the environment that we put those vehicles into, especially after that event, was those vehicles, when they come to Kennedy Space Center, they're getting processed. There's about a million man hours worth of work from the time an orbiter lands until it clears the launch pad again. So there's a lot of hands-on people, a lot of work. And we treat the cockpit area like a clean room. So you've got to get suited up. And you're going to be wearing like your OR suit and your full rubber booty that you're going to go in there on, your monkey suits, as we call them. And it's going to have an airflow that always is circulating things out of the vehicle. So the airflow never, you know, is very controlled coming in, but there's always a positive pressure. So it pushes any germs and all that other stuff out of the vehicle. So by then, it's pretty clean. But on every flight, you know, there's a few tiny specks of dust, or occasionally something gets lost somewhere. A friend of mine lost the watch on orbit. And they came back and they never found the watch, and they tore the vehicle apart, couldn't find the watch. And the next flight, the watch was just found floating around someplace.
That's hilarious. Only you could tell that kind of story. You know, nobody can relate to that. It's amazing. Let me ask you, here's another nerdy question for you. This is for me. I got to ask this. The static clean rooms, and you have to quarantine before you go up there to mitigate. Right. And, you know, how long is the quarantine process before the launch, sir, that you have to be isolated?
So it's 7 days. It's a week.
Oh, okay.
And the concept
it's that
is,
long.
Yeah. And the concept is trying not to get us exposed to any colds or flus. That's really what they're trying to prohibit. So there's an incubation period of all of that. And hopefully we're out of that environment. So if we're going to pick it up, we pick it up before we go fly in space, because being sick in space is really a lousy thing to be.
Oh.
And so they'll delay the launch if we get sick during quarantine. Anybody under 16 pretty much can't see us. And everybody over 16 has got to get cleared by the doctor, so they get to go in and have a physical. There's one event that we do with the family. where we do a barbecue at what we call the beach house. So it's our place for the astronauts to hang out and chill out while you're in quarantine at Kennedy Space Center. And it's just an old beat up beach house. I mean, there's nothing really fancy about it, you know, and you know, they try to clean it up and get all the rat poop and everything out of it but it's just the place to go. And you just kind of chill. It's nothing fantastic. And there's a bunch of empty wine bottles up on the wall with mission stickers on them and signatures on the bottles and things from all the crews. But it's your place to go to get away if you want to get away or walk on the beach or whatever your individual kinds of thing is. But L-2, 2 days before launch, we'll have a little barbecue. And you get to invite 4 people to the barbecue. So your siblings, your parents, and they'll get cleared by the doctors, come out to the barbecue. And then you spend a few hours out there having a barbecue. Actually, on my flights, each of my flights, I had we did a little mass on the beach. So we invited a local priest, you know, the local church that we were at. And it was a good deal for him. So he liked the gig because he got to come out there. You know, we had to pay his way and all that other stuff, but he got to come out, go on the beach, do a mass on the beach, you know, give us all a blessing and then tell the story.
That's so great.
Yeah, and isn't that beach house, like, it's in between, like, Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral, so you're, like, amongst all the launch pads.
Yeah, we're in the middle of some of the launch pads, and you can get pretty close, and you can go out and watch launches. We're about 3 miles down the beach from the space shuttle launch pads, but we're probably only a mile away from what used to be a Delta rocket launch pad, Titan launch pad. But it's kind of a neat place to go to. So you're in quarantine, and you know, it's not like people don't sneak out of quarantine sometimes to do things, but for the most part, you're supposed to, it's really all gears. And the hardest thing about it is saying goodbye to your kids. Most of the time you spend 3 days in quarantine at the Johnson Space Center, and there's a quarters there that we go into quarantine of our last couple simulators, fly out to Kennedy Space Center, and we'll spend 4 days at Kennedy Space Center in quarantine before we launch, all going well. Sometimes you get delayed a couple of days, so you spend an extra day or two in quarantine, but you don't have quarantine. But the hardest thing I tell folks is saying goodbye to your kids. It's hard to say goodbye to your kids. It's really hard. And NASA, being the efficient organization they are, is they give us, they want to make sure all our wills and, you know, last wishes and all that other stuff is all done, and they bring in the lawyers and they bring in all the right folks, and they give us cameras, video cameras, and cassette recorders. Back then it was cassette recorders, and stationery, so we can write letters or leave a message, and or go on a video camera. So that's kind of a hard part because you're in quarantine and you're writing this letter to your kids. You know, if you're reading this letter, it's not been a good day kind of a letter.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of heavy. A sucky thing. And then the best feeling, really, of all the things of the adventure of being in space and the thrills and chills and challenges is what I call wheel stop, especially if you're the front seater and you're the commander and it's your landing that's got to look good on CNN. So you come in and when that wheel stops and you call Houston and say, you know, Houston, Columbia, wheel stop, that's like the best feeling in the world because you're home.
Incredible. Wow. Well, Mr. Allen, I want to be respectful of your time, but I just want to thank you for taking the time to come on today. And I look forward to watching the movie on your life someday because it's fascinating. And I feel like we're better off as Americans in the scientific community because of your accomplishments. So thank you for your service and God bless you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. And say hi to your dad. I didn't make it to our 50th high school reunion, but I'll try to make one of these.
I'll let him know. He'll really appreciate that. And thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Matthew. Take care.
Thank you.
You too.